Thank you, Dr. Davis. And thank you for hanging in to the last presentation before coffee. And I'm going to change the crops a little bit. I'm going to talk about sweet cherry. And the work was conducted by myself and my wife, actually, Denise, at the Ag Canada Research Station in British Columbia, southern British Columbia. It's actually a fruit research station. It traditionally was apples, but we are actually benefiting from climate change. And we're moving now into sweet cherry, other crops, and wine grapes as well. And in fact, we are, of course, concerned about climate change. And this is some work that's been done on the projections into the future on various models of what's going to happen to the CO2 levels in the atmosphere. And we're in a narrow valley behind the Coast Mountains, traditionally very dry, 200 to 300 millimeters of rain per year, so it's an irrigated area. And the projections suggest, as time is going on, that we're going to get an increase in the degree days. Of course, that's going to be very pronounced in the valley bottoms, a little bit less so further up, but it's going to change potential production areas. But one of the main things, we're going to have up to 100% potential increase in accumulation of degree days above 10 degrees centigrade at the end of the century. And of course, that depends a lot on whatever scenario you're going to look at. If you have a low emission scenario, you're going to have less changes. So the supply of water is very important. We all know in the western North America that their water supply is largely snow melt or glacier fed. And it's no surprise that a lot of the great glaciers are retreating. I put the Columbia ice field, Athabasca Glacier, which supplies water for the Columbia River in Washington State. It's severely retreating. And there are other places around the world where there's even greater problems. So very obviously, water conservation is a concern in this region. And of course, there are a number of activities underway already. One is to convert to the micro jet or low pressure or drip irrigation systems. Some people are using mulching to conserve moisture. And the irrigation is being scheduled by use of measures of daily measures of evapotranspiration by that monitor you see there, and then controlling the amount of water applied the next day by computer, so that you're one day behind in the water applications, but it's to try and schedule the moisture needs and demands. And of course, it's always useful to be measuring the stress on the plants. And of course, one traditional measure is stomatal conductance or leaf water potential, but they tend to be rather discrete measurements. They're not a continuous measurement. And so there has been interest in looking at sap flow monitoring, which is a more continuous measure. And this study was undertaken to look at that technique for sweet cherry and to see if there's some practical way of using that. We started in the greenhouse, and there are a number of systems out there to measure sap flow. The first one I call the thermal dissipation probe. We actually made those probes from went down to Oregon State, was used in forestry. There is, of course, the heat balance probes, Dynamax, which are commercially available. And there's one out of New Zealand called the heat pulse probe. These two needle ones, one and three are two needles. They are inserted within about a centimeter within the trunk. And in number one, you have a heater, and then you use the granular equations to calculate the flow of sap. And the heat balance, of course, surrounds the surface. So you have to make it nicely, nice, tight, smooth fit. Surrounds the circumference of the trunk. And the heat pulse has in the center part there has a pulsing source of heat. And you can make measurements at two different depths and two distances. They're inserted at different depths. And of course, most of the needle probes depend on a calculation of A, which is a cross-sectional area for which the material is being transmitted. Of course, it's often, if you're dealing with a tree, not quite sure where that is. So we did the chainsaw technology where you cut a tree in the field, and put it in a saffron and dye, and then come back 24 hours later, cut it underwater so you get no other problems you take a look at where the die has moved to, and you can see this is the chainsaw take the tree apart. And see, it is active xylem is confined to most recent rings, and even these are fairly young trees. And but if you look at the circumference of that, you can see a bit of a worrying factor, and the fact that it doesn't look consistently around that circumference. It doesn't look like the pattern is consistent. In fact, there's a big effect of the graft, and there's sometimes an effect of the probes as well. But nevertheless, as I said, so these probes are inserted a centimeter into the trunk. You can see that would be well within most of those xylems, transmitting xylems. So you can calculate then the transmitting areas that you have to subtract off the trunk, which is a phloem transport, and then usually will be within that area. So you can make in inner and outer calculations. You have to do a lot of this when you're putting the probes in. So the setup started in the greenhouse, Stardust and Mazard, that's a cherry cultivar. And we had three different types of probes, for the TDP, Dynamax, and HP that you've seen in the first picture, four replications. We ran this under greenhouse conditions from Julian Day 66 to 133, which is in the spring of the year, February, March, April. We were finished by May. We used a typical orthic brown soil. You can see they're on a weighing balances. You can seal the top, prevent evapotranspiration of water through those funnels. And you can keep track of the amount of moisture that is being used there, because what you do when the trees are dormant, you plant them in there, you fill them up, let them drain, so you've got a field capacity number, then you continuously water to bring the numbers up to field capacity. We didn't adjust for the weight. There's going to be weight gain, of course, from the trees as they grow, but we did try only for a short time period. So here are some of the data on the diurnal sap flow. Were measured by the different probes. You can see all three probes along there. And one thing, and these are two of the four reps. I just put two side by side. So, again, disconcerting perhaps. They're not identical. So there is some, obviously, variation among the probes. But also, you'll see a pattern that follows the light. And these are greenhouse conditions, but you have supplemental lighting at that time of year. But you can see about 7 o'clock in the morning goes up. Declines about 7, so it's following the light and the temperature. But also, you can see there's different numbers that are generated by each of those probes. In fact, the thermal dissipation probes that we built ourselves had the lower numbers compared to some of these others' numbers. So we ran these things through for about an 8 or 9 week period to calculate daily. These are average values for milliliters for 10 minutes, because we had a data logger that accumulated the data. We summed it up per day and then measured the weight loss and compared it to what was being predicted to be moved. And I'll show you these. There's four replications in there. And the one-to-one line is Y equal X. So that would be if it was a perfect predictor. And these are for the TD probes. And you can see that there's a fairly nice internal consistency among those probes, the R squared values, but they are quite different for those four reps. And in these cases, they look like they're, remember this was one that had the lowest diurnal numbers, they're below that one-to-one line, so they seem to be not predicting what is happening there. This is the same data for the Dynamax gauges, which actually you can see much closer to the one-to-one line. So certainly if you're going to do the water balance studies, these look pretty good. Again, very high internal consistency. And these are the same numbers for the Transflow, New Zealand Transflow. They tend to be higher than the predicted line. But again, internal consistency. So we did a lot of work at that, and I'm talking about accuracy being the closer to the actual predicted one-to-one line. Certainly is an advantage to the Transflow and Dynagauge particularly. Consistency, they all were pretty consistent to each other, it's just that they gave different equations. So in some sense, you can see that they're going to be a correlative situation. We went on to work in the field. And of course, when you're on a restricted budget, the most important thing is system cost. We built those Park TDP probes, so I'm going to tell you that we then went into the field despite the fact that they were the least accurate. We use these. They have some flexibility and longevity in the field as well. And they're cheap because we built them ourselves when we went down to Oregon. So we now have a period where we're looking at these things and testing them in the orchard. And there's a number of trials. And I'm just going to show one here that we carried out in a commercial orchard for a three-year period, 2006 to 2009, on 68-year-old sweetheart Mazard sweet cherry. Now we did, so one of the problems you can see from those sectioning we did of those trees is that there's some variation around the trunk, so we tried to help these TDB probes by putting in two around the circumference to try and get a better representation. And we did this testing in an orchard where it was grower conditions with the irrigation, but because of the probes we had in there, his irrigation practice evolved through the years, and that was kind of through the time we had those probes in there. We had also a treatment in there. We had treated trees which were sprayed frequently and were others that were not. There's a lot of nutrient and other sprays that go on sweet cherry. There's been a concern that if you spray a lot, there's the size of sweet cherry is lower. So we were wondering about the stress caused by that. So that's a treatment effect was in there. This is what it looks like in the field. You can see the atmometer for our estimations, the ET. And then, of course, the data loggers and you need a lot of protection around us to shield those sensors from radiation and thermal noise, so they're set up to do that. I'm going to show you some of the data. This is the track of, for the two-year period, 2007 and 2008, during the growing season, and you can see there's a number of things put on there. The red numbers, the sap flow, and then the ET is the evapotranspiration numbers by that atmometer going through the growing season. There's precipitation events put on there in blue, and the blue squares are irrigation events. And if you start looking at these patterns, you can see that sap flow transpiration matches ET early in the growing season in both those situations. Rainfall events reduce ET and sap flow, so it's responding to the events, and just before harvest, irrigation increases sap flow, and of course that has an effect on carbon accumulation in the fruit. And in fact, the 2006 data I didn't show here, but it was remarkable. We put those sensors in, and he was irrigating at a very fixed schedule, not really based on soil very much, and there was a very consistent pattern. Every time he irrigated, the sap flow went up, so he began to realize that he had to adjust his irrigation pattern. He was actually getting increased production there. And here's the sap flow early in the spring, which is when things begin to move up, and you can see along the top there is a physiological stage of the plants. And really, the sap flow starts at bloom. It wasn't quite the same from one year to the other, but first white or just before bloom, open cluster. Those 2 years were quite different in temperature. So this is a time when you get remobilization and movement of nitrogen into these plants. So that was kind of interesting. Here's the spray program. Now, I didn't, between the sprayed and unsprayed, all trees receive dormant zinc, fixed copper, and spinosad. There's a problem with insects with the cherries, so they have to use that spray. But then there are a lot of other nutrient sprays that went on those other plants. We tried to do an analysis of variance with those four reps, but very infrequently do we find a reduction. It looked like it was a bit lower sometimes, but you couldn't really detect it very often, only seven times in about the 90 days over the 7 days or the 90 days of those three-year period. But if you plotted the ET, daily ET measured in the sap flow, you can see there's a statistically significant thing, but it also looks, a lot of variability in there, also looks as if there was a downward trend there. The other interesting thing was that the sap flow, once the ET numbers get very high, when it's very hot and dry, there seems to be a plateau. There's maybe a limitation where you cannot irrigate to overcome these things. There's some hydraulic limitation of the plant, and that was quite variable, quite interesting as well.
So a few practical implications. Water uptake starts between bud break and bloom. High EET and temperature may limit transpiration and photosynthesis. And irrigation can be monitored. Can we do better is a question. More frequent irrigation close to harvest in this particular vineyard or in this particular orchard would reduce stress. And it looks like foliar, if you're a little bit careful with foliar sprays, they can depress sap flow and have an effect on size. And we have seen that occasion with calcium chloride sprays on sweet cherry. So with that, I just would like to thank you for your attention, and I don't know if we have time for questions or not.
Thank you for the presentation. I'm going to take a couple of questions if you have any.
Was the dining age, were those slopes that were kind of the best, were those significantly different from 1 and intercept from 0?
I didn't have the numbers plotted there, but my feeling, and you have to be careful of the junction, the contact between the shield going around. It's obviously, I think, because it's around the whole circumference, I can see why it would be a better measure. But those, if you're doing water balance studies, I think that would be the way to go. But when you're in orchards, you know, you've got another issues coming up there. You've got the sturdiness and the cheapness, because you can't replicate a lot. So there is two sort of directions you might want to go with those probes. But we did use, because it was so cheap, because we made those probes and got to wear them all together. Quite cheap.
One more question. Jerry, you're talking about using sample. Is that you trying to use sample for irrigation scheduling? Or is
Yeah, no, we were interested in that at first because, of course, you would always think maybe you can wire this into a computer. But our irrigation scheduling right now is, especially for sweet cherry, we actually pulse the irrigation 4 times a day. But we measure the ET, and then we have the crop coefficient curve in there for the canopy development during the year based on the FAO curves. And so we automatically schedule irrigation. So I don't think this would be an advance on that. It was very interesting, though, for the grower to see these numbers, because he modified his irrigation when he looked at those things and thought, every time I put water on, the sap flow goes up, so those plants are getting more, there's more movement to assimilate and carbon in there. So he modified it because of just looking at that. So that was interesting to see.
That's what I thought. I think using the ET and crop coefficient is probably much easier instead of using irrigation schedule. So you answered my question. But also the one when you plot the ET and step 4, they got plateau in there. Isn't it because of maybe temperature get to certain points, sonata, that would,
shut down, yeah. But you notice there's a few fluctuations that you can't explain either, which are interesting. Yeah, the other thing about people trying to get these automatic sensors, of course, is there are people working on infrared sensing. There are people working on trunk shrinkage and swelling and trying to feed that into the computer. But we have fairly sandy soils, and we've found that atmometer scheduled irrigation to work pretty well. It actually also, talking about controlling nitrogen, and also if you control the water through the sand, you can change the residence time of the nitrogen that's going in, because we fertigate a lot of those orchards. So that's also an option with that system. So I don't think it really replaced that, but we were investigating and always hoping that it might.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Nielsen.